Hello, and welcome to Here's Where It Went Wrong, the show where every episode we sit down with one of our favorite comedians to talk about one of our favorite subjects and trace its history to find out where it all went off the rails. I am joined, as always, by Wen Powers. Wen, how you doing?
Andrew, I'm doing very well. I just got done with my work Zoom Christmas party, which basically means I put on a collared shirt while still wearing sweatpants and drank beer while we did office awards followed by a happy hour that we were just like, so, anyone have any trips planned for next year? And I gotta be honest, made me hate this pandemic more than ever.
So I've got, honestly, a number of questions here. One, I don't feel like this should be a thing. But two, did you win any of the awards?
I did not. I did not win a single award. I think there was like $500 in gift cards given out, and I won $0 worth of gift card money.
This sounds like a terrible Christmas party.
Look, I appreciate the fact that they put in the effort to do the whole thing, because they could have just not. Far be it from me to compliment someone that employs me, which I feel is a no-go, but I'm going to do it anyways. They sent me like a gift card for food and everything earlier in the week as a thank you. They sent me like a nice little like box of like little presents and trinkets and whatnot as like a thank you for the work this year. They're a good company. I really do appreciate them. It's just there's no way to make a Zoom office Christmas party work.
Yeah. And guys, this will be released in January 12th, but this is our last recording. This is our fourth recording in 5 days to get everything out ahead of Christmas. So we hope you guys had a good Christmas and a good New Year's. And I'm so excited for our guest. I'm joined by a good friend of mine. He has had his work featured in Funny or Die, Rolling Stone, The Nerdist. He's a writer, a comedian. He's recently started working in comics. His cartoons have been featured in the Midwest Hunting Magazine, Furfish and Game, and New Statesman, and they're absolutely fantastic. So please, David Slitterman, thank you for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. This is lovely to be here.
It is absolutely our pleasure. So we asked you what you wanted to talk about today and came back pretty quickly with chess. I was immediately on board. This was also, this was something I grew up with. Queen's Gambit has exploded right now. I'm very happy to see so many people really getting into this, that it's not just like a strict nerd thing before. But what about you? What was your history with chess?
My babysitter taught me when I was, I think, 8 or 9. And it was around the same time that, you know, my parents were not buying me Pokemon cards. So this was kind of like the next best game to play and the cheapest game to play. So yeah, he taught me. And then I went off and just kind of played with my brother, my parents. And then I got to a point where I was beating them. Not that they're good. This wasn't a brag. This was just, elementary playing. And then I got kind of bored of it and moved on. But then in fourth grade, I want to say, we had like an elementary school carnival, and I put my name in a raffle at the chess club booth to win, I think it was like Chessmaster 8000. It was like a computer program. The latest and greatest in PC software.
I mean, it's the 8,000th edition. It's got to be good.
8,000 of these. They make one every 10 minutes.
7,999 of those. I understand why you would skip them, okay? Yeah. But that 8,000 was the top of the line.
It was the big 8,000.
There we go. That's how many zeros that is.
Did I say the right number? Ugh, I don't know.
Yeah, you got it. That is 8,000. We are all smart enough to be playing this.
My main function on this podcast is cyberbullying people who are way smarter than me. So please, please take everything I say with a grain of salt.
Oh, yeah. That should probably be prefaced at the top of this, is that I don't think chess is really in any way related to intelligence. I want to get that right off the bat, that anything we talk about, it's not a flex. It's not a brag.
Right. No, I feel like I can actually consistently win against people that are bad at chess. And that's about the level I play at.
What a flex to just be like, yeah, and look, if you put me up against the worst players, I'm going to kick their ass every time. That's me being like, look, I can box any child. If you give me a child, I can fight him. Yeah. That's not me saying I'm a good boxer. That's just saying that I have no morals.
This is the level of skill we're all about approximately at here. You know, I was taught to play pretty young, and my family did not have any interest in this. So when I was maybe about 10, they got me, because this was before they had like the really big computer games for it. They got me the Kasparov electronic chessboard.
Oh, yeah.
Where you push on the board and then push again on the move you go to, so it registers it, and then it lights up where you're supposed to move the opponent to. And I won against this machine, and I went to talk to my parents, and I guess I did not have an understanding that there were levels of difficulty. Like, this was equivalent in my head to beating Kasparov. And I was like, why? We need to be signing me up for tournaments right now. How are you not more excited about all of this?
Oh, I'm sorry. Your son's a genius? Like, yeah. Just the idea of you going in there so smug and just being like, hey, mom, hey, dad, I hate to tell you, but I just beat a supercomputer in my bedroom.
It turns out it was on difficulty level 1. So I was not exactly killing it, but I honestly think they got me the game because it was like, cool, now we don't have to play with him. They were very abiding, actually. They played with me a lot, but I know none of them had interest. So thank you, mom and dad, for sitting down and playing this game for hours that I know you couldn't care about. So, Wen, how about you? What was your background here?
So I used to play chess a lot with my brother. Me and my brother would play all the time. My family had like this little chess board with like a drawer in it, so you pull out the chess pieces and like line them all up, and then you could put them back in. It was very nice. It was very sleek, and it was a very nice board. And I would play all the time, and my brother would kick my ass every single time. I would only play with my older brother, and he would always win. It was the most he would like toy with me. He would intentionally go and pick off all of my guys just so that my king was the only one left against an army, which was like such a demoralizing thing to just like be like, it's just one man against an army, and it's like, and he's not gonna win.
It is sadistic.
It was kind of fucked up, I will be honest. I was not as intelligent as him, and he knew that, and he was just toying with me. It was really like he might be a serial killer is what I'm getting at.
How much older was your brother than you here, by the way?
He's 2 years older, which is like, when you're a kid, is significantly older. So like, yeah, of course, 2 years makes up the difference for chess, like genius in my mind.
Of course, but not old enough that it made him a sociopath for toying with a child.
Yes, of course. Like, this isn't just like, yeah, my brother was 30 and I was 8. And like, a big thing for me was, I don't know if y'all remember, this is a deep cut. Remember the show Smart Guy on Disney Channel?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
There was an episode in there where, like, the smart guy, the little kid who was, like, a prodigy, could not win a chess tournament. So what he did was, he only took advice from his brother who didn't know how to play chess, and was able to confuse a supercomputer enough to beat it. And like, that was my idea, was just like, what if I played so badly? What if I played with no strategy whatsoever and just like Leroy Jenkins did the entire time? And that way I could beat the supercomputer, which was my brother. And it turns out that's a great way to lose every match against your brother.
Yeah, it's the nerd equivalent of Mortal Kombat button mashing.
Exactly. So I did not play for years. And then like, me and my wife played it was my first time playing in years. She was like, she was a part of chess clubs. She won chess tournaments when she was a kid. She's like, was very good at chess. And like, she kicked my ass for like 3 rounds. And then I won one of them. And she was so defeated because she was like, you beat me? And so we didn't play chess anymore.
So I think all of our backgrounds are about equivalent here.
Well, you guys won.
I did bury the lead. I kept playing throughout all of elementary school and ended up ranking pretty highly in 6th grade before, you know, never playing again for like 10 years straight. But yeah, it was the only trophy I ever won was a chess trophy. So it's,
I mean, you were a 6th grade chess champion. You were obviously drowning in women at that time and you couldn't focus on your studies.
Did you have a rating?
I think I did. I mean, it was like an under age 13 rating, and I was on the other end of that. But yeah, I got a nice tall trophy. It's proudly displayed as the only trophy in my parents' house. And you know, it's all been downhill from there.
Okay, good. So we've got someone here that actually knows what they're doing. Because no, I actually very much enjoy it. It's something I would love to get back into. And actually, I was wondering if we wanted to do some kind of game for this. If afterwards we want to do some like Twitch live stream or something.
Oh yeah.
And just watch David kick both of our asses.
It's me and Andrew versus David. Yeah. And I'm just like, do the stupidest move you can. It's going to work. It worked for the show Smart Guy.
Do the checkmate. That's the move.
Put him in a body bag. I'm just Cobra Kai-ing it the entire time.
good. So, all right, then after this, I'm actually going to have David teach me some stuff, because I have always wanted to learn actual strategy for this beyond the basic of, no, you got to control the center of the board. It was like, cool, but I don't know what I'm doing. So that doesn't help.
Oh, I do have one more thing to add. In college, 2 out of 3 of my roommates were all chess teachers. Like, they would actually go to school and teach people chess. And that was the other time that I played, was them just being like, and Siwin, this is why you're the dumbest roommate. As they just,
how are you not better at this? You have had so much exposure to chess champions.
Yeah, I've had a lot of exposure to them beating me. And then I'd be like, what am I going to be? Like, how did you do that? Like, they're smarter. They know what they're going. Like, I have had them try to explain strategy to me, but then my eyes glaze over and it's not a good look for me.
My chess teacher, my chess coach, I'll say, in elementary school was, I think he had moved from Russia maybe like 3 or 4 years prior. Just had a thick accent, loved like classic, like romantic chess, described everything with like such a hardcore Russian accent that to this day, whenever I play chess, I hear him in my head saying, oh, you've blundered, you've spoiled the game. And it's beautiful. I think it's the reason I enjoy playing, honestly. I hear him in my head.
If I had an old Russian man speaking in my ear, like my guardian angel, I would love chess.
So let's talk a bit about Queen's Gambit here, because I really enjoyed the series. I did not feel like it was a great representation of chess. What did you guys think?
What made you think it wasn't a good representation of chess?
I felt like there was so much consideration that obviously they can't show you in a series. They can't show you an hour of sitting down and going over what the move is. This is absolutely not a critique on the show itself. I get why it made people enjoy chess, and I honestly, I think it's the way they should have done it. But watching it back, I feel like it was very much just the extreme highs and extreme lows. And part of what I enjoy so much about chess is that it is a build. It is this constant back and forth, and that there is so much in the middle where you don't know if you're in control. And there's a lot that is obviously lost there and not something that could be conveyed in TV. And I hope people that are getting into chess because of it don't get discouraged immediately when they see that it is more complex and it's like there. Because I think they put a lot of the complexities into the mindset rather than their strategy. That's why this game is such a beautiful game. And it's one that you can really get immersed in.
Yeah, I did think they took out a lot of the more boring aspects of the game, or I guess less cinematic qualities of the game.
Which you should do if you're making a TV show.
Yeah, it's a smart it's decision. Call. Even for a miniseries and not just a movie. Yeah, they also had a lot of plot to pack in.
And they also had an absolute genius as your main character here. And it's obviously she's going to be seeing chess in a way the world isn't seeing chess. This is not necessarily a representation of the game that we're going to be playing. But it's still, I thought, a very good story. And so when I talked about it in an earlier episode was how many people like immediately Googled this. Like, was this real? Did this really happen? They clearly captured something that made the public believe that this was a real story. And I thought they did a fantastic job with it.
I will say, like, from a cinematic standpoint, accuracy wise, it's one of the most accurate representations of chess.
Really?
By a long shot. And I think part of that was like they had a grandmaster, Garry Kasparov, was like an advisor on set. He would come up with either positions. Whenever there was a chessboard on the screen, he would be coming up with what the position was, or, you know, pulling references from old classic famous games and just setting them up. And it was all like Easter eggs. I don't know if you followed the chess Reddits, just like analysis of every episode, they'd point out like, oh, this is the Night at the Opera game. And like, oh, this is Fischer versus Spassky. And like, it's just these little gems that, you know, 1 out of 1,000 people is going to care about. But as far as like, if you think about like, I mean, the famous examples of like when they play chess in X-Men or any movie, I just watched one movie the other day where he's like analogizing chess to war. And they're like, you know, in chess, the best player knows that you have to sacrifice pawns to win the game. And you're like, okay, that sounds cool, but you know, that's not like a big rule in chess.
Right. By the way, David made a face when I said I didn't think it was an accurate representation, and now I completely understand why. I want to be clear here that I do not know enough to be looking at the game and thinking, oh, nobody would have made that move. The moves made sense from this idiot's perspective. but from the idea of that they are showing you the highlights, the games themselves, yeah, I actually really enjoyed watching the play unfold for the bits they showed us. I really liked watching that. I think the part that, for me, the very low level of understanding was just in the concept of what the experience was. But obviously, this is supposed to be heightened. This is a woman who is dealing with alcohol issues and can believe she can only envision the board when she's high. This is not supposed to be, oh yeah, this is going to be your chess experience. This is the grandmaster, this particular tortured grandmaster's experience.
Yeah, I will say, I don't think the show did a good job of capturing what it's like to do horse tranquilizers for fun.
They missed the mark on that one. But I mean, you guys both enjoyed this. I mean, I feel like everybody enjoyed this.
Oh, it was great. It was a great show. As entertainment, especially when it came out, I mean, I like during the election, I like was watching it as just like a, oh, this is something that will keep my focus while the world is going insane over here. So like, it was a good little escape for that.
It was actually perfect. I will always remember the show as an election distraction.
Yeah.
Right. The one that kept me from going insane during these few days.
I'll watch someone else go insane. That's perfect.
Yeah. And well, if you guys haven't seen it yet, absolutely do check it out. And do know that, as we have learned from David, that the actual gameplay was some of the most realistic you've seen in movies. You can also watch X-Men if you want to hear about how you need to sacrifice your pawns. Those are your two options for chess in movies.
Can you believe Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart didn't know how to play chess when that movie happened? And
neither of them did?
Yeah, the two coolest, most they're knights. They have pizzas named after them.
Those are the two standards. Knights have pizzas named after you.
I would like the cool Magneto lines from the X-Men movies to be replaced by Ian McClellan just doing his best guess, where he's just where someone's about to attack. He's like, wait, in chess, the horsies go first. It's so close, man.
I would have bet money. Like, I picture them just playing for fun in their free time. I mean, I can't really be disappointed in them. They're both absolutely killing it, but I'm very surprised. But let's get a bit into the history here, and I'm going to keep this one a bit more brief because we've got a lot to cover here. But when you start getting all the way back, the earliest records of chess date to 7th century CE in India, with precursors in the 6th century during the Gupta Empire called Chaturanga. And some of the basis here is obviously India was the country that has founded math that allowed it to develop in the way it did today. The development of the concept of zero was thanks to India. This extension to chess is not really surprising. And the term for the game that translates to four divisions, the infantry, cavalry, elephantry, and chariotry, which are represented by the pieces that would become the pawn, knight, bishop, and rook. And then it just kind of spreads across the world slowly by kind of the people that conquer it. It's introduced to Persia, became part of the education of Persian nobility. Then the rules develop further. The player is called Shah, Persian for king, and Shah Mat. The king is helpless, which became check and checkmate, and the Islamic conquest of Persia led to further spread across the Middle East and to Russia, and in the 9th century, it had reached Western Europe and Russia by at least three routes. By the year 1000, it spread across Europe, and as it's taking the world by storm, it starts growing in various forms in different regions, including versions where you're playing along the lines instead of along the squares. And of course, as it gets popular, we reach the thing that we do in so often our history episodes. We start reaching these church sanctions about it.
Wait. I just want to say, I like how there are different versions back then because, I play Star Wars chess. Yeah. we're still innovating this game.
Yeah.
Yeah, forgot to mention, I did have a Simpsons chessboard that I definitely led to a lot more growth than a regular boring old chess game.
I had a friend with a dragon chessboard, and it actually made me a better player because you couldn't tell any of the pieces apart, so you had to remember where everything was. It was so badly made, and I actually did improve a bit after playing on that board for a while. So we've got all of the church sanctions. It's typically banned for religious leaders. Like early on in the year 1005, it's banned in Egypt. All chess sets were ordered burned.
They didn't like how the bishops kept getting fucked up.
Well, it's because they thought it was a gambling game, right? Like they thought it was a game of chance.
Only if you're bad at it.
The takes on why this happened were a few, because 1128, you get the Knights Templar were forbidden to play. Eventually, the Jews allow it to play, but not for money was a specific rule they had. But you also get the Council of Trier, which you might remember from our witchcraft episode, because they mainly dealt with witches, and they forbade chess from being played by the clergy. And then, of course, the Puritans ban it, because they do that with everything.
Well, yeah, it's a classic Puritan move.
Yeah. So this is really surprising that chess actually survived all of this. And then there was banning, of course, of different races. Jews are banned from it during World War II in Germany, of course, and slightly before. One surprising one was chess was banned by transatlantic mail during World War II to keep it from being used to send coded messages. This was something that was actually done. And they're like, okay, but we've got to deal with, like, the real stuff. We can't have, just don't play chess by mail, guys. We've got enough going on here.
Just nip it in the bud.
Yeah. But the modern game really developed between 1475 and 1500 with the introduction of the Mad Queen chess, or chess with the Mad Woman, allowing the queen to move in the way that she does rather than like one square at a time. She could now move diagonally and across the whole board. And this became the format for the game we obviously play today. It seems pretty consistent throughout the development.
I just want to say, I don't think there was a bigger step for feminism than when they were like, the queen can do whatever the fuck she wants.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was a big moment for women when they're like, the queen can go anywhere. You can't tell her what to do. She's the best one on the entire board. It's just like, yes, yeah. Yes, queen.
That's what made it explode. Chess was very boring until the queen was juiced up like that.
It was. It allowed games to be finished in, I mean, they're still taking a really long time, but in an acceptable amount of time now. And yeah, it allowed the game to become so much more popular.
My strategy was unleash the queen as fast as possible and fuck up as much as you can before they kill her. Like, that was my number one strategy. And you know what? Didn't work.
I'm hearing the Russian voice in my head. Do not bring the queen out so early.
Yeah, I now understand why in chess the pawns go first. We're just going to say that a lot now. Because, like, I was immediately just like, let's get the queen out there. Let's get the queen out there to really mess things up.
We should definitely have, like, an all-comedian game of chess. I feel like it's going to be bad, but way more entertaining.
I would be a terrible general is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's the overall message here. Well, then in the mid-1800s, you get the actual first official chess tournaments. The chess clock is invented shortly thereafter, and that changes things because now you can have speed chess and lightning chess, and it really changes the way the game is played here. But that really starts to bring us to the modern era, which is also where things not surprisingly start to go wrong. So, David, where did this go wrong?
Hey, everyone. Before we get into today's pod, I want to tell you about Blue Wire Hustle, a brand new program where you can host your very own podcast here at Blue Wire. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle is the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to our community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll help you get your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and all other listening platforms. And the best part is, you can get all this for only $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge you just for the initial setup. So whether you're starting from scratch or have an existing show that you want to grow, Hustle is an open door to leveling up your sports experience. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bwhustle.com/join. Check out the description box to find out more, but that's bwhustle.com/join.
So, David, where did this go wrong?
Well, so my favorite part of chess time was definitely, you know, like the romantic 1800s period of chess where it was like people were playing for the art. You'd look at these games and people would make just bonkers moves, you know, sacrificing their queen for no, seemingly no reason, and then swooping in with another piece or sacrificing all of their pieces. And like the other player would also at times be helping. Like it was more of like you were both collaborating in this piece of art, like building to this awesome game. And it was very cool and very fun. And then obviously theory started coming in and people started planning out positions. And I think the two kind of sides coexisted. You know, you had people saying, okay, there's good openings and bad openings. There's good mid-game strategy and bad end-game strategy. You can still find romantic flares, but, you know, you don't have to be a dumbass about it. You can meet halfway. I would say the point where it really started to go downhill was the introduction of computers and the analysis and the ability to look at a game objectively and say, no, this is the 100% right move or this is the 100% wrong move.
It's such an interesting development because it seems like computers would be ideal for this. I mean, this is largely a mathematical and, of course, a very strategic game, but it did really usher in this new era where instead of playing instinctually, people are memorizing move sets and trying to come up with what is mathematically the best move. And computers have obviously reached a point where they're close to unbeatable. Certainly the top players still get wins in, but they're not really winning a full tournaments against them.
I think they're unbeatable. I think they are literally unbeatable.
Did Magnussen ever play them? Carl Magnussen is the current champ, by the way.
I think he refuses because he knows. That's the crazy thing, too, is that like chess, if you talk about games in terms of solvability, like checkers as a game was solved, I think, kind of recently. Like, they figured out, okay, if you go first, here's the perfect amount of moves and you will win. Connect Four, Guess Who has been solved.
Yeah.
Pac-Man. Pac-Man has a strategy.
By the way, I said Magnussen. It's Magnus Carlsen, who is just a kid. He's like 22 now with the highest ever chess rating with a 2.882.
That's a bad sign for him, and we'll get into that later.
Yeah. Well, and but computers have achieved a rating of 3,187. And it's in the 80s when they start being competitive. By the way, like the origin of this is the Mechanical Turk, which came out in 1770, which is this box with supposed hidden mechanics inside. And this is this unbeatable chess machine. And it lasts for about 80 years. And it's just a guy inside moving it by magnets. But they're getting chess masters to do this. And people are coming just to lose to the Mechanical Turk. And it was absolutely incredible. And also they've got chess masters willing to sit in a box and move these pieces around with magnets.
And they don't get the glory. It's like the end of the movie Prestige. It's standing under the...
It's for the love of the game. And for, you know, just fucking with people mostly. But look, I mean, Turing worked on this. In the 80s, you do finally get them becoming competitive. But then the big one, when things really change, is Kasparov and Deep Blue. I don't know if you guys remember this at the time. I think I'm older than both of you. But I followed this at the time. And this is a six-game series. Kasparov won one, drew two, lost three. The second one, by the way, which he does lose, he accuses IBM, Deep Blue, of cheating, of somehow knowing his moves ahead of time. This is still kind of considered impossible. And the breakdown of this is what they figured out is it's not just about studying the moves or studying the mathematically correct moves. It's about studying the past players. And this is why this 1997 as improved version from Deep Thought, which Kasparov did fairly well against in 1989, is so advanced because now they've started programming the Deep Blue based on previous grandmasters' style of play. They've also now, the technology advanced enough that Deep Blue can be considering his moves to 11 and 12 moves out. And this depth of this play has advanced to a point where players have suddenly said, look, if I mean, he can calculate 200 million moves a second. We can do strategy. We're good at this. But when someone can calculate every possible option and see the most likely one, which is where you get something like a smart guy, where it's like, oh, if I do something stupid enough, it won't know what I'm doing and I can extend the play. Because I think from this game, they had actually said you don't have to beat it. You just have to last long enough.
I think one of those games, Kasparov actually did do a crazy, like considered bad opening because he was like, this is going to throw off the... Watch this. This computer's going to suck. And it whooped.
Yeah. No, he did try a couple unexpected openings.
And then the computer was just like, checkmate.
Yeah. But I think this was the start of where it went wrong in a lot of ways. And it's still a game I absolutely love. But I think it switched a little bit. This was a very artistic game. It was a game that you could see in the romance era. And now this became a game that was very hardcore. And one thing that's not discussed too often, because people debate whether or not it's a sport, but the current players are undergoing training regimens. They found that players can burn 6,000 calories a day sitting playing these tournaments just from the mental energy they're expending. There have been tournaments that had to be canceled because one player over a long period where the game just kept going, he lost 20 pounds and they were worried for his life. The level of physical stress from the mental energy put into this is insane. So I get the switch. I get why it left the romance era to the hardcore practice where you now have ones that are on very specific diets. They're on training regimens. They're working out in the gym, you know, to train for their chess matches. And it's this weird dichotomy, but it has also led to much less of the romance era, which was one of the things that was so great to watch.
I'm just imagining seeing a guy that's like fucking jacked and be like, oh, I wouldn't want to play him in chess.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to play Chris Hemsworth. Have you seen that fucking guy? That's a master chess player's physique right there.
Yeah. Magnus Carlsen, obviously we had mentioned before, he used to drink orange juice beforehand. He said now he gives up sugar, supposedly, for the months before a tournament because he doesn't want to deal with the dip in energy. He was, you know, saw a nutritionist, and then these people are being trained, people that trained athletes to get them in shape to compete in chess tournaments. And it's incredible the depth of the game. And that is actually one thing that I very much enjoyed about Queen's Gambit 2 was that they showed why and how people got so obsessive over this, even in an era where it hadn't quite reached that level. Obviously, this was before computers, but still on a personal level for these players, it was always there because, yeah, this was something that you devoted your life to.
Well, and if you look at all of the top players and their ages or track, you know, top players as they age and how they progress in ratings, like you do see there's kind of a median age around 30s and then people dip. And it's not because your brain gets dumber as you get older. It's that it takes a lot of concentration. And, you know, even when you're training 6 to 8 hours a day, like when you get older, it's just you just don't have the time for it. Or, you know, you're not able to memorize so many moves as much. And it's becomes kind of a young person's game in that regard.
Absolutely. And I think that does tie into we had a couple of points here where we thought this is where it went wrong. And it led to a lot. So, Wen, how about you tell us a bit about some of the mental aspects of this game? What happened to some of these players?
OK, so do we want to get into players first or do we want to get into some cheating scams?
You know what? You did some really good research on this. Where do you want to start?
Okay, so I'll just start with computers have had a kind of a big effect, but there's a thing where people love to try to figure out ways to cheat in chess. One of the first main, like, high-profile ones was in 18... So a big thing was collusion, which is players would go in and they would pretty much go in with the decision of just like, look, you and me are going to play each other to a draw. I will lose this match. You will lose that match. And there was actually an argument when they figured this whole thing out, when they came to them and said, you guys can't do this. The response was pretty much, there's no rule that says we can't decide if we're going to win or lose a match beforehand.
It was the Air Bud defense.
They're like, you're not the boss of me. You can't tell me I can't lose a match if I want to lose a match, which is an insane argument just right out the gate.
Some of the strategy behind this was that it's the physical tool we talked about. They don't have to play this game anymore. It's not just going to damage their rating too much to play this game to a draw. And they are in much better shape for their next match than their opponent's going to be, who played a potentially 8-hour game and had to win it.
Yeah, and basically they went through and they were like in the last century, they went through and they looked at all the world chess champion matches and they realized that the Soviets had been colluding with each other for like 20 straight years, which is why they had like an unbeatable record, because they kept going in with the mindset of just like, look, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And they pretty much all went in just knowing exactly who they were going to get to that last match.
And the Soviets also did something that they've done with gymnastics and ballet and other arts, in that they took so much national pride in these games, which is surprising when you find this result, that they would sponsor their players. You know, their players would get paid to play chess. And that is a huge advantage when you're facing an American who is kind of needs to win this tournament in order to survive.
And not even just that, but like in the 60s, 70s, the pinnacle of both the Cold War and chess, like Russia was, they were like going through every single school, testing all of the 5-year-old children, like pulling out the good, the ones who showed promise, and then just teaching them nothing but chess for the rest of their lives.
Oh, yeah. It was intense. And they obviously gave us some of the greatest players of the world. But also there is this 20-year period where it's like, guys, we know this is technically allowed, but come on. You can't keep doing this.
Like, stop. Come on. Like, could you imagine LeBron James going out there and just being like, look, there's no rule that says I can't lose the game on purpose. Like, that ruins so much of the fun.
I mean, I guess you also get, like, Boris Spassky is the chess Beyonce, really, if you think about it.
That is the first time we have ever heard that sentence.
Oh, I say it every day.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to computers, I mean, you have examples of people using technology to start cheating in chess. One of the earliest examples of this was in the 1993 World Open. An unrated player came in wearing headphones they said were to concentrate, and he scored a 4.5 out of 9 in the open section. So he took a grandmaster all the way to a draw. So he was playing insanely well. This was being a little suspicious. Everyone's like, we've never heard of this guy before, and he just tied a grandmaster. How is this possible? So they had him take off his headphones, and then they asked him basic chess questions, and he couldn't answer any of them. He was having somebody watch the match and tell him where to move the horsey and things like that. He did not know the game of chess at all, and they never figured out who he was, like, talking to. That's one example. Another big one, 2010, there are three French players. One was in the tournament. One was at home watching the tournament on television and entering in the moves into a computer to figure out the exact right move to make. And the third guy was in the room of the tournament, standing up and, like, walking to different chairs and, like, sitting down in them to signal what the next play should be. So just imagine, like, just one guy looking up to watch another man just kind of run around and, like, sit in a chair and, like, stare at him.
You know, I did that with the game Battleship at recess when I was in first grade. We had someone writing on the whiteboard the areas to call out, and I would just sit and read them.
Wait, what is the benefit of cheating at Battleship? What was?
Because you win. You win the war. You win the Battleship.
I use the French one and the headphones one because those are, like, the most interesting examples, because the rest of them are purely somebody saying, I have to go to the bathroom, going to the bathroom, and either calling a friend or using a smartphone app. Like, all the major cheating scandals in chess are somebody being like, hey, do you mind if I take a 5-minute bathroom break? And then going in there and being like, how to win chess, Google.
What my favorite one, though, that you had found here was a guy who did just that, except instead of, like, using a program, he's just playing a chess game on his PlayStation.
Yes, he had a PlayStation portable that he brought into the bathroom, and, like, he lost. Like, it was not like an expert program. He was cheating, but, like, he was using the worst software to possibly cheat of just a PlayStation game, and he got his ass kicked.
Also, how bad do you have to be at cheating to be cheating and losing and them still to suspect you of cheating? Like, you are bad at all aspects of this.
You're suspiciously bad. You're bad in a weird way.
You're bad in a way that would expect, like, Crash Bandicoot to be bad. Yeah. Why are you playing such a Crash Bandicoot style of play?
So this is, yeah, I mean, you're right. There was a good deal of this. And eventually, once we reached the era of computers, it was basically the same thing. It was someone found a way to sneak a computer in. And it was effective. It was largely effective. Obviously, it's going to be more challenging at the top levels when it's not, you know, when they've got to sneak this program around. But it happens far too often. And I think this also speaks to the change in what was once a gentleman and a gentlewoman's game. This has become so highly competitive. Again, not that it wasn't before, but in a very different form now. Which, when I think, also brings us to some of the mental state of some of these players.
Andrew, I did so much research for this. Oh my God. There's no paper that links the reason for this. I have no, like, direct correlation for why one leads to the other. And I'm going to, like, try to be as respectful in my language as possible when I say this. But people who play chess to that level are very likely to lose their fucking minds. I think that's the most respectful way I can say that. There are so many examples of chess players that just went off the deep end so far that it is mind-blowing to me.
By the way, I appreciate how much work you did researching this. I know every episode I say I did so much research on this. I know you did on this one too. And we want the public to know how hard we work for you, for the listeners. We appreciate you being here. So what I started looking into around this was the percentage of actual geniuses that have gone crazy, because it's something that's talked about quite a bit. But it's obviously just one of the challenges of psychology as being a soft science, is that there is not something we can point to and say, you know, this is exactly what we found. Because you find some articles where they say this happens a lot. One of the more recent ones I found from a psychology professor at Harvard said, when you look at the statistics, this is not happening that much more often with geniuses. In fact, it might be happening less. What you do see is geniuses thinking non-linearly. they're thinking in ways, and because of that, approaching things in ways that are unappealing to the public. They also might be more prone to certain things. Again, this was a separate article where they said they seem to be more prone to things like bipolar disorder, but actual things that might be qualified as this insanity, not really, this Harvard professor posits. It's more of the fact that the way they think is not considered acceptable to the public. However, you see a much more extreme version in chess, where maybe it's just one of those things where the public latches onto it, because every time it happens, it's this huge thing. But we did have a number of chess players that seem to suffer from schizophrenia or some form of insanity. You also have people like Bobby Fischer, who was just ragingly anti-Semitic. And I hate that he got painted in this corner, in the same category as being insane. It was like, maybe he just hates Jews, guys. I'm a Jew. I've dealt with this before.
Okay, so let's back up. So for those who don't know, Bobby Fischer was a child prodigy. When he was 13, I believe, he played in what was known as the game of the century. He is barely past a child. He, you know, he is a newly minted teenager, and he plays an international chess master and fucking wins. Like, that is how good he is at chess. He barely has, like, puberty going through his veins, and yet he has the mental capacity to beat one of the greatest players in the world at chess.
And as an American from Brooklyn, no less, with zero training.
Oh, yeah. He was an absolute prodigy.
When he was 14, he became the youngest U.S. chess champion of all time. When he was 20, he became the first person to win the world championship in 11 games. He won 11 out of 11, a perfect score, which had never been done, and I don't think it has been done since, to win 11 out of 11, okay? He was the world champion in 1972 and then refused to reclaim his title in 75, which a lot of people think might have caused some kind of mental break, because he immediately went and became a full-on recluse.
He also pulled some crazy stunts during that world championship too, which were kind of indicators looking back on what was to come. But I think at one point he was convinced his chair, the chair he was sitting in, was like, you know, had some sort of like Russian toxin in it or a microphone of some kind. He had them like completely dismantle the chair and inspected the whole thing. There's just things that were like, okay, something's going on, but we're not going to question it because you're very good at chess. And we're gonna...
You're so good at this game.
Right. He also had this thing where he would enter tournaments for an agreed amount of money. And then as soon as the contract was signed, he would demand more. He was one of the most challenging to work with in general, and things that generally suggested instability. And again, his style of play was very out there too. And for the most part, this was accepted. And he's again made numerous anti-Semitic speeches. He claimed Bill Clinton was a secret Jew and the CIA were all Jews. And it was a lot of really, like, not that like, oh, this guy might have an issue with Jews. It was like hate speech and constant. And it was kind of constantly pushed aside too. It was like, yeah, but he's so good.
But the man can play the hell out of some chess.
Right. It's actually not until 2001 when people finally say, okay, this is too far. So when? What happened in 2001?
In 2001, I'm not sure if you heard about this, but 9/11 happened. Big thing. It's why you have to take off your shoes at airports, in case you were curious. And here's what happened. In 1992, Fischer did a rematch versus Spassky, who was the number one player of Yugoslavia. That is who he beat in 1972. And so for his great, like, I'm back, bitches, moment, in 1992, he was going to do a rematch against Spassky underneath the United Nations banner in an unofficial game. And what is needed to be mentioned is Yugoslavia was currently under an embargo with the United States. We were not supposed to have any interaction with Yugoslavia. And they told Fischer this, and his response was basically, fuck you. And he went and he won that game. And then America was like, hey, you're under arrest, buddy. So he fled to Iceland. So when 9/11 happened, he came out there all like just going nuts and was just like, guess what, guys? This was the coolest thing that's ever happened. He was like a 9/11 cheerleader. And then at that point, everyone went, guys, I'm starting to think Bobby Fischer's kind of messed up.
Yeah. I mean, that was, again, he had done so much here that should have had him out of commission. And this was the one where, I mean, rightfully, I agree with the decision. But that finally was like too much. It was like, guys, yeah, I mean, a lot of people died here. You're good at chess, but it's still chess.
I don't think you're that good at chess.
Right. You can't be good enough to make this acceptable.
Well, isn't it crazy though? Like, you think about like when a musician, when something crazy comes out about them or something just vile, and you're like, I'm never listening to their music again. Despite the Bobby Fischer saying probably the most horrific stuff a person could say about terrorism or the loss of human lives, you could still play it through his chess games, and it's amazing. It's art.
The guy's very good at chess. Not a good guy.
Yeah, and also he doesn't get royalties from us watching his previous chess games. And I think that helps a bit. That's always the challenge with art, separating the art from the artist. It's like, well, yeah, but as long as they get my money, we're not really separating the art from the artist. You guys, feel free to go look up Bobby Fischer's old games. He will not get paid for it. And they are fascinating games.
He's dead. You can do a podcast that you've monetized all about making fun of Bobby Fischer. And it turns out you don't have to pay him a damn thing.
Yeah.
We can say his name as much as we want. Bobby Fischer.
That is a great point, guys. We're doing it right now. I didn't even consider that. It was like, guys, we didn't even have to. Yeah. I kind of forget what this job is sometimes.
Andrew, you're currently making money making fun of Bobby Fischer. That has to at least even scales a little bit, right?
I mean, I'm not enough money for that level of anti-Semitism, but I'm feeling good about it.
Part of the thing about his insanity, too, is that he was half Jewish and, you know, had a Jewish upbringing. And it's like, okay, there's definitely something that's gone wrong here.
Something that he tried to deny for years, but his mom was like, yeah, okay, but I'm Jewish. So it was, I think, one that I mentioned more because when you start reading the accounts, and I think also because I read them again shortly before the show, and there are some of the more horrific anti-Semitic statements. Like, there's enough. I'm a comedian that's on the internet. I get this a fair amount, but these are some of the more horrific ones you'll see. And I dislike the idea of linking that with insanity because it's something that you do see in normal people and is not a result of mental illness. It was just part of who he was, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't a mental illness component as well.
Okay, Andrew, that guy, okay, we can maybe say there wasn't mental illness there. So how about I tell you about another chess player?
Are we going to hit Morphy? Because Morphy got some stuff going on.
Morphy's got some stuff going on. So yeah, let's get into Paul Morphy, who is known as the pride and sorrow of chess, which I got to say, incredible epithet to have on your name.
Yeah.
Paul Morphy became one of the best players in New Orleans at the age of 9. Like, people would come and try to play this 9-year-old in chess, and he would whoop on them.
Yeah.
At 13, a visiting Hungarian chess master was beaten in 3 games by Paul Morphy. And once again, 13 has to be some kind of weird age where all of your chess superpowers come out. Because it always is like 13. It's like, and then he became really good at chess. I don't know what it was.
That's actually when the X-Men developed mutant powers, too. So
I was just thinking that. It was like, all right, I think we got this.
Whoa. Full circle.
Paul Morphy received his law degree in 1857, and he was too young to actually legally practice law. He was so far advanced, he was able to get the degree, but legally, they wouldn't let him actually be a lawyer. So instead, he became just the first U.S. chess champion. Like, he was just like, this is my gap year. I'm going to become the world's greatest chess player. And so he did. And then he traveled to Europe, and he just went around Europe playing every decorated player in chess and kicking their asses. By the time the trip was done, he was hailed as the greatest player in the world and the unofficial world chess champion.
This is only about 10 years after chess tournaments officially started, by the way. They weren't really prepared for someone to be this good, this consistently.
Yeah. And then he got back and he was like, okay, guys, I'm done playing chess. I'm not going to play chess anymore. Instead, I'm really going to focus on this law thing. But he wouldn't shut the fuck up about chess, and he drove all of his clients away.
Also, didn't they treat it like, oh, why would I hire you? You play chess. Like, as if it was like, you know, it was a sign that he didn't take anything seriously. It's like, yeah, you're good at chess. Why would you be good at real life?
Right. Here's the thing. If I went to a lawyer and was just like, hey, I need you to represent me in a court of law, and he was just like, yeah, but let me tell you about my Call of Duty days. Yeah, I would be a little bit like, I don't want to do this with you. We're not doing whatever this is. I want to talk about my problems, not how good you are at the game you like.
And now there tends to be this assumption of chess equaling genius, which again, was not always the assumption, but also not always the case. You can be very good at just chess. You know, you can have a very logical mind, but this kind of be the only thing that you understand. And now I think it's kind of entered the zeitgeist in a mindset of, no, if you're good at chess, you're a genius and you're going to be good at everything. And at this time it was like, yeah, you're good at chess. Does at any point, did you read a law book?
Well, here's the thing with Morphy though. He might not have been like a great lawyer, but he was fantastic at living off of his family's wealth and just wandering around New Orleans, muttering to himself, which is what he was mainly known for near the end there. He would just like find people on the street that he thought looked interesting to him, and he would follow them through the streets of New Orleans until they went inside their homes, because he would not stop otherwise, muttering to himself about chess the entire time, which is scary as hell.
Yeah.
Didn't he have a crazy death too?
Oh yeah. So this is, and I will say that this is, might be more urban legend than fact. And so I'm going to preface that in just in case any Morphy heads are just like really just diving into this podcast. It's alleged that he was discovered dead in his bathtub from a stroke, surrounded by a perfect circle of women's shoes.
That's the way to go.
That's what I'm talking about.
Look, that's how, if anyone's going to do it, that's how I do it. That's how I
do it. Old circle of women's shoes having a stroke in a bathtub.
Wasn't the stroke he intended when he laid out the shoes.
Oh, God. That was a good layup.
Come on.
That was the whole reason we did this whole episode.
That was just for that joke. That's it, folks. We're done.
Paul Morphy doesn't even exist, idiots.
But Morphy was one of the extreme examples, one of the early examples, too. We've also got William Steinitz, who, again, started playing young, which is something you see in pretty much all competitive athletes in any form. He played more competitively in his 20s. But what happened with Steinitz? And then I know there's the one that you really want to tell us about in Pachushkin.
I'm so excited. Tell us about Steinitz. Steinitz is all you.
Okay. So Steinitz went from being the third player in Vienna to the number one, where he won 30 out of 31 matches. He traveled to London, competed competitively, doing well enough that he could just focus on chess. So this became his career. So eventually, though, Steinitz took this 9-year hiatus from chess, and he's developed a style that went away from the attack style that was very popular at the time, and instead created the positional strategy that really became the basis of modern chess strategy. This is, again, mid and late 1800s. So he was revolutionary in the game, but he takes this 9-year hiatus from chess, instead focusing on chess journalism and frequently challenging the chess masters who criticized his analysis of the game. None of them actually wanted to play him. It was like, cool, but you're writing the thing.
Yeah, basically, they were just like, he would just write something making, like, mocking their style. They would be like, hey, fuck you, man. And he'd be like, okay, well, will you play me? And they'd be like, well, let's not do that. Let's.
Right. Like, imagine it, like, if you were owned a restaurant and a restaurant critic critiqued your food. It was like, okay, we're going to have a cook-off. And it was like, okay, but no, this is I'm cooking. You can just go write another article. I'm just mad. So he eventually came out of retirement and he hits up the tournaments again, eventually moving to the U.S., becoming a citizen. But it's not until after finally losing his title that Steinitz suffered a breakdown, and he was actually put in an asylum and would spend his days beating the other residents in chess. But the big thing was, later in life, he would tell others he had devised a system to communicate with God, wherein they would play chess together. And Steinitz claimed he beat God on many occasions, and probably didn't. I mean, technically, we can't say that for sure, but I'm skeptical.
I just love the idea of him losing his, because he was the world's first official world chess champion. He was the first one to ever exist, and he lost his title, and it might have caused some kind of mental break. But what kind of bounce back is in saying, look, I might not be the world champion, but I beat God?
It's also just like, he couldn't just go the step of, yeah, I play God in chess, like, as if, like, okay, I've got you till then, let me just tell you also that I beat him.
And it's like, you know, if this was real, like, God let him win. He was clearly an exhausted person. At some point, God was like, you beat me. Good job, Steinitz. But on the articles I read about some of the, again, thought process of geniuses and connection to insanity, they had mentioned, too, that some of the studies to do a comparison studied the thought processes of people in asylums. And they found that there was no correlation, that the processes that we typically saw in geniuses was not there in people that were suffering from mental illness to a degree that to have them institutionalized. And in fact, the conclusion of this particular professor was that those that did go insane would probably have been even better had they not suffered from this. This was not contributing to their genius. It was, if anything, a hindrance, and they were in fact just so good that they could play beyond it.
Could you imagine being that good with like a handicap?
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. But I think that brings us to Wen's favorite. He was telling me about this and it was fascinating. So Wen, tell us about Pachushkin, who was not a professional player, but was by far the most interesting.
Okay, so I found this and I was just like, look, this is going in the episode no matter what. Alexander Pachushkin was a Russian resident who was very aggressive, and it was a burden on his family how just aggressive and mean he fucking was. They sent him to live with his grandfather, who decided, I'm going to teach him how to channel this aggression through the game of chess. And he did. He picked it up and he was good. He would go to the park, and he was known for just going to the park and beating the shit out of everyone in chess. He was very good, but he never rose to that professional level. Now, around the time of his adulthood, they noticed that there were a lot of people who were being murdered, and they would be bludgeoned from behind. And guys, okay, I'm just going to say, just a content warning here. It will be a little bit graphic here going forward if you want to skip ahead a few minutes. So,
this is a podcast, though. This is what everyone's here
for. It's what people are here for, but I do want to give a content warning since we don't normally talk about graphic violence on the podcast.
I'm not going to listen to this part.
Please don't. So he would bludgeon people. This Kurt killer would bludgeon people in the head and then shove a full vodka bottle in to lobotomize them as just a way of just like as an extra kind of fuck you to whoever he just murdered. I don't know the exact reasoning here.
I would be very concerned if you did.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, oh, it's so that the alcohol. It's just like really, that's how you know that if your co-host is fucking insane, if they're able to completely tell you why they shove vodka bottles into their victims' heads. Anyways, eventually a woman's body is found in this kind of state and they go through whatever security cam footage they have. Guys, this isn't far away. Like, this isn't a long time ago. This person is still alive. They go through security footage and they find out that the last person that she had contact with was Alexander Pachushkin. And so they went to his home and they found out that, yeah, it's Pachushkin, and they arrested him for 49 murders. 49 murders.
I'm gonna say it, that is too many murders.
That's way more than you want. And when they arrested him for them, his response was, there's 11 more you guys haven't figured out yet. Can you add those on? What the fuck?
Wasn't he trying to get 64? He was trying to get the number of squares.
Well, yes, he was trying to get 64. He was trying to get 64 because when they went through his home, they found a chessboard. And on each square was the date of a different murder he committed. And he was trying to get to 64 to fill up the entire board. He was known as the chessboard murder. Now, I will say a lot of people think that he was just doing that as a gimmick and that once he reached 64, he wasn't going to say, and I'm done now.
I mean, no, you can buy another chessboard.
He was going to buy another chessboard. Like, this guy was not going to stop once he hit 64. They didn't get him right at the end and keep him from finishing his dream. He was definitely going to do another game. There was going to be a chutes and ladders style set of murders if the chess thing finished. But that was the most insane thing I had ever read. And I was like, this is going in the fucking episode.
It's absolutely horrific. And again, this was the chess tied in this place, I think, is a lot more like, I feel like this was a guy that just wanted to be really good at chess. It was like, you can't force this. You're not like, I get it. You enjoyed playing with people in the park. You don't need to make this your whole thing.
If you can't beat them, murder them.
Yeah. This is his catchphrase when this becomes a movie in like 4 years.
But like, he's alive. He's not dead.
No, this was recent. This was like very recent. This was what, like in the 90s?
Yeah.
How could he have? I'm surprised. Maybe I don't listen to enough true crime podcasts, but 49 murders sounds like every podcast should be about. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. That's so many murders.
I mean, that's a really good point, is that we've got serial killers who are like, oh man, he killed like 5 to 6 people, and like 60 people. That is a ton of people. like your ideal murder number is zero. So it is way more that I hope you, everyone in the audience already knows this, by the way, but zero is what you're shooting for when you're getting to know a person.
But like to fill up the chessboard with the dates, I mean, that's one of those things where I'm just like, oh my God, that's insanely fucked up. But also, how have I never heard this before?
Right.
That is so specific.
This really seems like it should be a story that, well, I'm glad we're telling it. We got there first, guys. Don't Google it. I don't want to know if anybody else got there first.
Fuck you, sword and scale.
Well, I think that is generally what we love about chess, that it has an absolutely fascinating history. I really do enjoy games. I love board games, but there have been very few where I have felt as immersed in a world as I did in chess. And it was something that I could very much get into. And what we've so strongly disliked about it is, of course,
the 49 murders. Yeah,
the 49 murders is really like the worst part. But other than that, it was the introduction of technology into the game that has really changed the style of play. But of course, we do have the section in their defense where one of us has to defend that. We're not going to defend the murders. The murders, I think we can all agree, should not be defended. But David here is going to defend the actual introduction of computers and chess. So David, in their defense, computers and chess, what are your thoughts?
All right. Without upsetting the world of chess fans out there who hate computers, I mean, it's bound to happen no matter what. Like that's just what's going to happen with technology. And you know, if it's bound to happen, it's at least cool that we're living in the age when it is happening. To the point about, you know, older players getting worse as they play longer, I think a lot of that has to do also with them just getting comfortable. Older players come from a time of being more comfortable with just, they could play one opening for their whole life and get away with it. I think the introduction of computers has led to much, it's an exponential amount of discovery about the study of chess, about new openings, new strategies, new ways to play that you've never had before. So you've got people studying, you know, obviously a lot more than they used to, but it's well-meaning and it actually does produce very interesting results in that, you know, you're able to gut check these things. It moves against computers. You're able to get better and see yourself get better by mathematics. There's also, you know, people who, you know, might not know many people who play chess. Like I played my parents and my brother for a while when I was a kid. And then I had a chess program and I started playing that. And that's when I started getting good. So it's, you know, the teacher and that you can have in your pocket on your phone. I think it's, while it's making people cheat at a far higher frequency, especially now in COVID days, everyone's playing online. Chess tournaments are being held online. It's very easy to cheat, but I think it does just kind of cause people to try and be better. There are ways to detect cheating in certain moves that you can make. They're getting good at better at snuffing it out and finding out if you are cheating. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's leading to a new era that is completely unexplored, and we're all figuring it out together. I'm in for it. I'm in for the ride.
I actually agree. Again, that game that I had as a child was a big thing for me. I kept that for way too long until I could finally play online. And yeah, I mean, I think it's changed some of the nostalgia of the game, but the development of strategy has been beautiful. And when you're able to look at a game and see the elegance behind it and realizing that these games too, it's not cold, it's calculated, but the reason they're doing well is because it's still beautiful. They're still coming up with very creative ways of play and it's advanced the game. It's just happened to take some of that romantic nostalgia out of it. And I can see positive and a negative to it, but you know, it's not like I needed a program to beat me. I was going to get beaten by most people.
Yeah.
This is an advancement not required for my level of play.
Yeah, we're not sitting here like bemoaning the fact that we can't beat the supercomputers. Like, I can't beat not even a prodigy. I won't win against a regular 13-year-old.
Yeah.
Like, a regular 13-year-old who plays chess occasionally will kick my ass no matter what. So I'm not bemoaning the fact that computers were introduced. I mean, and there's a lot of games that, you know, you could say that, like, some people say that, you know, computers can ruin baseball. And it's just like, no, because you're not playing against a computer all the time. Like, yeah, you're going to play one-on-one against people. It does make cheating easier. But when the game is played, you know, to the best of your ability by two people, the game is still pure. The computer does not have to be involved if you don't want it to be.
And I think something we've seen, and this ended up coming up in so many episodes that have dealt with the history, is that there will always be romantic nostalgia in humans. The game has definitely changed, but it doesn't mean it was always this pure romantic era thing we view it to be now, there's always going to be that thought when considering that there is a different style of play now. The way we saw it when we were kids doesn't mean that's the way it always was. And I personally am just glad that it's becoming more and more mainstream. This really is a beautiful game. And if you haven't played it, we hope you will. Also, if you enjoy this episode, if you'd like to see us play, we always have the link to our DMs in the comments. Let us know if you'd like to see it. We can set up a Twitch stream or something and have David kick both of our asses. But most importantly, David, thank you so much for coming on. It was an absolute pleasure to talk about and have you explain some of this to us.
Yeah, this was a joy. No one ever, I never get the chance to talk about chess for this long with anyone, so I'm glad I could force you guys to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing it, and especially letting me, indulging me as I talked about people who suffered from mental illness while I laughed. That's, it's not a great look, but it's what I did.
Yeah.
But it's recorded forever and ever.
That won't bite me in the ass.
Absolutely. This was so much fun. If you guys enjoyed this, please subscribe, leave 5 stars. It helps us out so much. If you would actually like to see us play, then we always have the DM to reach one of us in the comments. Let us know. We can set something up on Twitch or something and watch David kick both of our asses. We hope you enjoyed it. We're going to be back next week with another episode. We'll hope you'll join us again then. And we'll see you next week, Wen.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.